matter is City of Ferndale versus Rosa.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Peter Dwork and I represent Art and Margaret Rosa. In this case, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Proceed.
Well, out of all the cases I've heard this morning, I think ours deserves to go last only because it seems that the gravity of the circumstances is much less than those of the others in terms of worldly perspective. But in terms of perspective to my clients and the parties involved, I don't think it is minor, although it may seem. One thing in reviewing the record here that I want to make sure is that the court understands the timeline of events. I don't think I did a very good job in briefing that, partially because we had two consolidated appeals. So I'm going to briefly review that, unless the court instructs me otherwise, and then I'm going to touch on the few legal issues that I think we have here. I think this case is relatively straightforward. To start out, the history of the case is quite certain and well described in an unpublished opinion by this court as well as outlined by the parties. The timeline I'm speaking of is the one relevant to the appeal. On November 25th, 2015, the City of Ferndale filed a motion for entry of this consent judgment pursuant to the settlement agreement. That finally went to a hearing on February 12, 2016, when that consent judgment was entered over the objection of my clients. There was an initial contempt hearing based on their alleged failure to comply on June 23rd, 2016, and the contempt order was entered on the 24th. Those orders were issues of the first appeal. And then fast forward to February of 2017 and March and April, and additional contempt hearings as well as a judgment assessing a $25,000 contempt penalty that was in March of 2017 was entered. And then following that, there was an award of attorney's fees for slightly over $10,000. Since all that has occurred, as you've seen in the city's response in the consolidated appeal, the judgment has been satisfied. The contempt has been purged. And the city is arguing this issue is moot. We argue it's not for one sole reason that remains, which is the judgments assessing financial penalties and attorney's fees against my clients have not been satisfied. They were specifically accepted from the satisfactions, and there's a forbearance agreement that requires them to pay for at least another 6 months. So they are currently paying the City of Ferndale $3,000 every month. That's the timeline of events.
For a total of about $35,000, is that what's going to be here?
Yeah, $35,508 and change, I believe, was the final amount once those were added.
Let me ask you this. Missing from the recitation is any indication of a stay of the underlying order entered by the trial court, a stay of the underlying order entered by this court, or the posting of a supersedious bond to supersede the effect of the order. So my question is this. It's because when I read this, I have a somewhat different take from how you folks have briefed it. You both seem to assume that it matters whether the underlying order was proper. But if the order had been entered, and if it wasn't stayed, didn't your clients have an obligation to obey it at the risk of being held in contempt in the absence of a stay while it was on appeal? I mean, you can't just simply get an order stayed by filing a notice of appeal.
I agree. I think what you're about to say next is where the issue may be. What I hear the court saying is, did you stay the orders? The answer is no. There was no stay. They were obligated to comply with the consent judgment, and then the contempt hearings proceeded. In the interim, contempt orders were entered, and now before this court, that original judgment has been satisfied.
So isn't the question now just whether the contempt order was properly entered flowing from the underlying order, not whether the underlying order was properly entered?
Yes and no, and here's why. Yes, in the sense that the penalties we seek to have reversed are based solely on those latter contempt orders, but those contempt orders were entered solely on the presumption of a valid judgment.
Well, no, not the presumption, the existence. It was valid at the time that your clients were found in contempt.
I don't disagree. Now, the issue I think the court's raising is void versus voidable. In other words, in the context of, say, contracts or statutes or other things, legal actions can be taken pursuant to a document or a statute or a rule, and if that thing is voidable, all actions that lead up to it before it's legally voided by a court are valid. But when a document or act by an entity is void, for example, the corporate doctrine of ultra vires, if a corporation or an individual doesn't have authority to take an act or enter into a contract, that contract is invalid, and all acts pursuant to it are invalid, regardless of when that is declared. The one example, because it's fresh in my mind on another issue, is if a municipality, let's say that a city council enters into a collective bargaining agreement with a group of employees, and one of the city council members happens to have a conflict of interest in deciding that and votes on it because that city council member's husband is a city employee. Is that collective bargaining agreement void, or is it voidable? The answer is it's void. It never happened. The same thing applies here. The contempt orders are void by virtue of the fact that the judgment they rely on was void. I don't think this is a voidable versus void question. I think there's no question that the court had no authority to enter contempt if the judgment was void. And I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Dannon Traxler. I am the City Attorney for the City of Ferndale. And Judge Dwyer, it sounds like you are taking this in a different direction, but the City is responding to the arguments submitted by appellants.
Well, you briefed it, and feel free to argue what you briefed. But I'm struck by that question. If there's an order that's not stayed, and can someone be found to be in contempt of it? Yes. And are we then just looking when what we've got left is the contempt sanction? That's what keeps it from being moot. Aren't we just looking at the propriety of the contempt sanction? He had an answer for that, and I'm curious as to your answer.
I would agree if the court wants to take it in that direction, you could definitely narrow your holding to that. I would like to address the...
No, I'm not saying that you shouldn't. I had a question from looking at this.
And if the appellants are arguing that the judge didn't have the authority in the first place to enter the initial order and the contempt orders flowed from that, then I think we have to address that beginning question. And the city is first asking you to dismiss the appellant's arguments on RCW 4.60 because they are raised for the first time on an appeal and should be barred. And in the alternative, we're asking you to dismiss the appeal because the trial court clearly didn't err when it entered a consent judgment on terms explicitly agreed to by the Rojas in terms that are allowed under applicable law. So with the first issue, I don't want to belabor it too much, but as you know, CR 25A only allows for issues to be raised for the first time on appeal if they're related to a lack of trial court jurisdiction, if there are matters of fact. There are matters of fact that can't establish a material case, and then also if there are manifest errors affecting a constitutional right. And I would submit that the Rojas didn't assert any of these exceptions in their briefing. They briefly touched on the issue of trial court jurisdiction in one line on one page of the brief, but this is related to an 1877 statute, RCW 4.60, the prerequisites of which are signature and notarization of an agreement for a confession of judgment, which we, of course, argue doesn't apply here. But that seems like a technicality, more of a process-related issue than anything that's jurisdictional. And here, the statute actually requires the signing of a statement agreeing to the entry of a judgment. And in this case, we have the signing of a memorandum of settlement, signing of a settlement agreement, and the signing of a stipulation by the appellants, and then we have a signing of the consent judgment by the appellant's attorney. And so for all practical purposes, you could argue that we substantially comply with the requirements of RCW 4.60, and the appellants haven't submitted any arguments as to why there would be a jurisdictional bar to that.
In terms of arguing, as you are prepared to do with respect to the issues that are raised in the briefs, I wonder if you could help us out by articulating what do you perceive the Rojas argument to be on appeal that you are required to meet here?
I think that the Rojas main argument, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around the application of RCW 4.60, because that statute only applies when there's a judgment for money due, or if you're trying to, I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. It has to do with contingent liability, to secure a person against contingent liability on behalf of a defendant. And neither of those are circumstances in this case. So 4.60 doesn't apply to this case at all. They also argue that either complying with 4.60, which requires a signature and notarization on the consent judgment, or the filing of a lawsuit are the only way to enter a consent judgment. And this is just absolutely not the case. CR2A governs stipulated agreements between the parties, and it allows for those agreements to be filed in court. RCW 2.44010 allows for parties to be bound to an agreement or their attorneys to bind them to an agreement if it's in writing or if it's done in open court.
Your position is, although there was no ongoing proceeding to which CR2A would have applied, the parties contracted to make CR2A applicable.
I think it's a two-sided argument, because I do think there were proceedings. There were two administrative appeals that were pending.
Civil actions in a superior court that would be governed by the civil rules. CR2A is in the civil rules. So there was no action pending that would be governed by the civil rules. But there was an agreement specified what the conditions would be, just as if you had made it up, like CR2A had never existed. And you said, use the exact same words to say, this shall govern our agreement.
Right. And regardless of the consent judgment, we could have filed a motion to enforce the settlement agreement without the consent judgment under CR2A. But you're right. With this agreement, we contracted to certain terms. And those terms were very clear. We consented to governance by CR2A. We consented to governance by RCW 2.44010. The Rojas explicitly agreed that no summons would be required, that no complaint would be filed, that there would be no service of process. So they agreed to a very simple notice of default prior to the hearing, and then just notice of the time and place of the hearing. That was all specified in the settlement agreement and the stipulation. They agreed that a consent judgment could be entered against them in Whatcom County Superior Court. They agreed to venue explicitly in Whatcom County Superior Court. And the case law shows that a choice of forum clause in an agreement confers personal jurisdiction, because how else could venue lie in Whatcom County Superior Court if the parties didn't intend to consent to personal jurisdiction? So all of these items are very, very clearly spelled out. The Rojas also agreed to finish all exterior completion of their house. They agreed that the city could submit affidavits and declarations detailing the circumstances of the default. They agreed that the construction would be in compliance with the International Residential Code and also the terms of their permit. So it wasn't just about completion of the house. It was compliant completion, which makes the declarations or the affidavits from the city really important here. We had to spell out how it wasn't completed and how it wasn't compliant to the judge. The consent judgment had blanks for us to fill in to ask for relief. The settlement agreement and the stipulation allowed for that. The Rojas explicitly agreed to allow the city to submit all of these things. So the consent judgment was submitted in substantially the same form as the Rojas agreed, but for those items that they explicitly agreed to allow the city to submit. So very clearly they agreed to this. So in answer to your question, I think their argument is, first, RCW 4.60 applies and that we should have gotten a signature and a notarization on the consent judgment, but that doesn't even make any sense when you think about this from a contract perspective. Because if this is a bargain for a contract and the Rojas are getting a lot of extra time to complete their house, what does the city get if we can't file the consent judgment, if we actually have to file a lawsuit in order to file the judgment? We then lose that consideration. And so that's what we got. We got the guarantee that if they were in default, we could file the consent judgment without a lawsuit, without a summons.
You commence the action by filing a motion rather than a summons and complaint.
Correct. That is correct. That's the way the language read. But it also explicitly stated that all that was needed for notice was a notice of default and not any sort of complaint.
And that was a contractual waiver
of correct.
The service of a summons.
Yes. Yes,
and that's
exactly.
Jurisdiction, which can be waived or can be altered by contract.
Exactly,
you can serve this corporate person instead of me, the CEO, by contract. But I can't even think of the name, CT Corp.
Right, and the U.S. Supreme Court supports that there are a variety of legal ways that people can consent to personal jurisdiction, whether implied or expressed. So surely the parties can contract for that when we're both agreeing for venue to be in Whatcom County Superior Court, and that the judgment could be entered without a complaint. So that's the city's position. There are some other arguments here. The city's alleged default on the settlement and therefore inability to enforce it, that is a red herring argument. The terms of the settlement agreement explicitly made these two permits separate. There's a spire permit and a building permit, and there was language included in the settlement agreement that said, you know, the city's review of the spire permit does not excuse any obligation to perform under this agreement, which was the Rojas' obligation to finish the exterior of their house, to do so in accordance with the IRC, and to do so with the terms of their permit.
Is this over now?
The house is completed. The judgment has been satisfied. So the two remaining issues are...
Ferndale no longer has any concerns with the violations of code or anything like that.
No. We have resolved
those.
It's
the money.
It's the money. Yes. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to touch on the jurisdictional arguments here, and I want to focus on Judge Dwyer's line of questioning. I agree that a party can contract away certain rights with respect to jurisdiction. And I looked at the cases that the plaintiffs have cited, and I tried to do some – or that I've tried to do some research on this to find anything that exists otherwise.
You're speaking of personal jurisdiction.
Personal jurisdiction. So the court has subject matter jurisdiction, right? I mean, CivPro 101, personal jurisdiction, subject matter. Superior Court, subject matter, not an issue. Personal jurisdiction. All of the cases where parties agree or consent to jurisdiction are done in contracts, private contracts, are with respect to long-arm jurisdiction. And so here's the distinction. When we talk about jurisdiction, I want to sue Alabama Corporation and Washington courts. Well, there's a contract that says they subject themselves to the personal jurisdiction. Great. I send a summons, no question. No minimum contacts analysis, nothing. In another instance, if they don't contract for it, where do we look? Well, we look to the long-arm statute as to when that is appropriate. And within that, we have to serve appropriate service of process. Through a plaintiff's actions, the court grabs somebody and brings them in, okay? I have yet to find a case that says that summons process of service can be accepted absent following the statutory procedure. So if you think about this, how does a court get jurisdiction over somebody when an action is initiated by a plaintiff? You serve a lawsuit. You serve a motion. You serve a summons that says you're being sued. Now, we get so complicated in what we deal with these days, we sometimes forget about service of process. I mean, I haven't seen a service of process case come out in a long time because the form is there. CR4 tells us what to put in a summons. The statute says you can do it one of this
so
way.
You serve an initial pleading.
Yes.
There's a wide variety of what they're called, depending on the nature of the action.
Yes.
But I don't understand what you think is missing here. There was initial pleading that was filed. It was the notice of motion.
Right.
And it was notice of that was conveyed to the other party or conveyed to your party consistent with what was in the agreement, right?
I would argue no, not consistent with what was in the agreement. The substantially similar form that the city of Ferndale argues, their appendix to my first brief in this case, we stipulated, assuming for Chapter 406 was complied, 460 was complied with, which it wasn't.
I'm not asking for the request for relief was the same. I'm asking whether the method by which notice was accomplished was the same.
The method by which notice was accomplished was as outlined in the stipulation that was signed. I agree with that. Okay. What I'm saying is that still does not authorize a court to have jurisdiction over an individual unless there's a law or some type of authority that says it. In other words, under what Your Honor is saying is anybody can contract for any reason to do anything in front of the court, and as long as I send them a letter that says, hey, come to court, otherwise I'm going to do this against you, then it's possible. I don't think that's the case. I think there are some rules.
Something that has to be cognizable. But this was, I mean, as long as you brought us back to Civil Procedure 1, yeah. We might as well
I might have
get
myself.
The shivers. And, I mean, Mullane versus Hanover Trust, right? Is it reasonably calculated to inform the other party of the existence of the action?
Right.
Are you saying that this did not meet that test or it didn't meet some other test?
I don't think it meets the test that the way you commence a civil action in the state of Washington, according to the statutes that apply to Superior Court, are service of summons under 428.010. That's what it says. Under the civil rules, that's what it says. All of the cases that I've found about consent judgments and other things of consent deal with following a statutory procedure to get into lawsuit land. Once we're in lawsuit land, you can enter consent to judgments. But my assertion here is the trial court had no jurisdiction because 460 wasn't followed and no summons was served.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes our calendar for today. Court will be in recess.
Thank you.
All right.